So good morning, everybody. As you know, this week we have an invited professor that is going to give his seminar on external AI. Just to remind you the timetable, today we are meeting here 10 to noon, and then in the afternoon we have a first hands-on exercise. Everything is in the Moodle already, so you can download all the materials that you're going to use this afternoon there, but it will be in the same room, so you will use your own laptops and probably work in pairs in solving the exercises. Then tomorrow, and day after tomorrow, we're going to start at noon, and we have noon to 2, and then starting at 3, so we'll have a break of 1 hour in the middle, okay? Then, basically, it's my pleasure to introduce you Dr. Sebastian Lapushkin. He's the head of Explainable AI group at Fraunhofer HHI in Berlin. And in fact, although being very young, he has won several awards already. He's the recipient of the Hugo Geisen Prize for Outstanding Doctoral Achievement and the 2020 Pattern Recognition Best Paper Award, which is something that is highly regarded. So I would like to thank you, Sebastian, for accepting our invitation, for coming here, and I hope that we can learn from your experience in the coming days. So thank you very much.
Okay, yeah, thank you for the introduction. Can everybody hear me? Also in the back rows? Okay, great. Yeah, thanks for having me. Today I'm going to talk a bit about, or in the next three lectures, I'm going to talk about explainable AI, what this means. We're going to start with local approaches, which means typical heat map representations. We go beyond looking at heat maps in the second lecture and the third lecture. I'm going to show you how we can use this information to actually improve and fix model behavior. So this is me, as a short overview maybe, to demonstrate that I know what I'm doing. I started working on explainable AI in 2012 at Technical University in Berlin during my master's thesis. And since then, I have co-developed a couple of methods for explainable AI, evaluating explainable AI, etc., or in the end, fixing models using explainable AI. In our latest publication, the mouse pointers here, which appears, it already has appeared digitally, but it's going to appear in print in 2022. Our first encounter with CleverHans was 2016. Now you might ask yourself, what is CleverHans? We'll get to that later. But it's an by now important concept in AI. Okay, like I already said, this is the overall structure of the lectures. Today we're dealing with local XAI, which means explanations obtained for individual predictions made by the model. Tomorrow we go towards how can we evaluate explainability and what can we evaluate with explainability. We go from local to global explainability, and in the end we look at what's in between local and global. Local means, as I said, explanations for individual model decisions. Global explanations tell us something about what the model has learned in general. And day three, as I said, I'm going to showcase two approaches to improve model behavior or efficiency using this information. Let's maybe start with an overview of what machine learning actually is and what it's for. So traditionally, also in contrast to programming, right? So we use programming for automating data-dependent tasks. And if we program something or we create a program to do stuff, we know the data usually, we know how to handle this data, those should be the rules, and what comes out in the end is the process data usually answers in some form, right? Either binary values or some strings, whatever, anything you'd like to do. The point of this is to be efficient, reduce human labor, and get as much output as possible in the most consistent way thinkable. Okay, the problem here is, one second, I need to figure out when the slides are transitioning. Okay, got it. Right, so what if the data is not fully understood, or if the rules you need to process your data cannot be formulated clearly, precisely? This usually is a problem for programming, and this is where programming gets towards, or yeah, moves towards its limits of doability. And this is also where machine learning comes in, basically. The idea of machine learning is we have some rules in the data, we know some answers, linking the data, basically linking between data and answers, but we don't know the rules, how to get to those answers. And this is where machine learning comes in. We can train machine learning models by providing the data and the answers, and what comes out is, in the end, a predictor. And the predictor internally already contains all the rules, right? And we potentially could then pick this predictor, i.e. the rule output machine learned from data, into the programming task. This is what we do in practice. And then we have basically this learned thing which replaces the manual creation of rules for solving difficult tasks. One such example can be seen to the right, for example. How can we measure there's a cat in the image? If you would want to do this with classical programming approaches, for example, creating rules for how cute this image is, whether it has whiskers or those structures or something else, this will be really difficult. And just to put a time frame to everything of this, deep learning has tremendously helped in this. And the re-emergence of deep learning in about 2012 or so was able to solve those problems more successfully than previously, because at this time we had the compute power, we had the data to feed those compute machines, the GPUs, we had novel model architectures which were able to infer those rules and learn those connections between the answers, the data and the answers in terms of rules, in order to solve those problems. So if, for example, if you look at ImageNet challenge results in those years, you will see that performance is slowly arching up, and then at this point, someone used deep learning on GPUs, and phew, then we went up like this in terms of performance over the years. So, as I said, data, the availability of data, and of course compute, is a major driver for machine learning. And luckily, contemporary data sets, not only for images, but also for openly accessible medical data, are huge, with thousands, or in terms of ImageNet, millions of samples over thousands of classes, providing ample of examples for the models to learn their rules from. However, data is also the major problem for machine learning, because data is rarely perfect, and there might be errors, for example, in the data in terms of labeling errors, or there might be correlations in the data which might confuse the model. So the model does not learn what we actually wanted to learn, but it learns something completely different. And the problem with that is that common machine or modern machine learning models, and by that I do not only mean deep neural networks, are usually so complex. And since the transformation and the rules they learn are end-to-end learned, which means you just plug in your data and you say, model, I expect this answer, anything happening in between is learned without human interference usually. It's just a blind process. It's doing something, you don't know what it's doing. And this leads to the models being a black box, which means you can put in an image of a rooster and the model will tell you it's a rooster and you might be happy, but there's no guarantee that it's actually solving the task in a way which is interesting or relevant to you. And this is especially critical if you have, for example, a medical task and you want to make sure that the diagnosis the model is predicting is actually medically founded. And as I said, data quality might be problematic. And if you look at those examples, do you have an intuition what might be problematic in those examples? The left ones are all boat pictures, okay, classes boat, and the right ones show you in red text the true label annotated in the data set, and the prediction is down below in the black font, right? I can give you a hint. Those images are all boats, however, all those boats are in the water and the horizon line is approximately similar in all images. In the right, we have, for example, orange labels, or we have oranges in this data, in the sample. Here's the mouse, here we have oranges. However, there's also lemons and grapefruits and kiwis. And here the label is soccer ball, but there's also some dog in there, right? And if you use this information to train the model might get confused potentially, or the other way around. If you evaluate your model performance based on this data, which has confusing information, we might not get an insight on the true performance of the model because our measurement is wrong in the end. So data quality in machine learning is key. If your data is not fully representative to what the model should be doing, you can assume that it will fail at some point. Because if you train a machine learning model, the data is the complete reality the model will see. It has no background knowledge. In typical machine learning approaches, you give it this data and this is everything it knows. And if this reality has errors or it deviates from your reality, the model might not generalize. This is where explainable AI comes in. What we can do right now is, or what I would call consolidated XAI is, so XAI is short for explainable AI, is the ability to, for a individual decision of the model, get a representation in terms of feature importance, here like we see in this heat map. Oh, I forgot to start the recording, shit. Okay, I quickly restart, right? I skip myself, I skip the overview, and right, sorry, I've started the recording. So let's start again what programming is for. Programming is for automating tasks, right? Data-dependent tasks, and the key is here, in classical programming, we know the data, we know the rules, how to handle this data in order to come up with answers. This is all well, however, what if we don't know the data? We have a bunch of data, we don't know the rules, how to handle this data, or the data is so complex that the rules need to be equally complex such that we as humans might not be fully capable to encode those rules sufficiently well by typing them out, for example, in C programming language. This is where machine learning comes in. Machine learning takes the data and the answers and is trained to learn the rules to connect the data and the answers. And in the end, we might take the machine learning predictor and plug it in as the rule part in classical programming in order to basically have an automation pipeline. And one example is, for example, this cat image, where it's hard to measure, for example, whether it has whiskers or whether those structures are something else. Is it cute or not? And cuteness might be an indicative factor for some classification. For example, we might want to divide cute cats versus not so cute cats, for example, in our machine learning task. For that, data is key. In order to train a machine learning model, we need to have ample data and the data needs to be representative. However, a problem is that data might contain errors. For example, correlations we do not want in the data. We might have labeling errors, like we see in this Stock et al. 2018 paper. And together with the complexity of modern machine learning models, this leads to black box predictors, where you put in a sample, you get an answer out, that answer might be correct with a high probability, you might be happy, but you don't have a guarantee whether the model is actually acting based on the features which make sense in your sense, right? So here we see the samples from before, and as I hinted before, we have to the left some examples showing boats. And what might be confusing to the model there is that all the boats are in the water, right? So what happens if the model predicts for a boat which is not in the water? If it has learned the correlation that water is present and therefore it must be boat, the model will not generalize to boat, it will generalize to water because it doesn't understand the textual name of the labeled boat. In the right case, we have labels in orange or red color on the samples, and those labels only explain part of the story. For example, there are oranges in the top left panel, but there are also kiwis and lemons. And if you train a model on this information, it might get confused if, for example, there's a certain mean behavior over those samples, because all oranges might co-appear with kiwis, for example, in the training set. Or the other way around, the model correctly predicts there's a kiwi in there, but we just don't count it as a correct prediction because the model is actually more correct than our labeled data set for our evaluation. All this might cause problems, and this is where explainable AI comes in. And in the terms of giving glimpses into the black box machine learning models by, for example, what I would call at this point consolidated state of XAI, which means for each prediction and outcome, we are able to get a heat map visualizing the feature importance of the input. For example, here we see that the rooster is important, or the rooster's head is important, and then we can do some interpretation work and say, okay, I see this thing, it has been predicted as rooster because it sees those red skin wattles on top of the head. And this has been used as a feature to detect the rooster, and there are some secondary features. I don't know if you can see this, but down here, on my screen at least, there are some weaker responses in heat maps, which tells us secondary features are the feathers of the rooster. Okay, now we are here, where we've been before. Okay, what do we gain by this transparency? And one thing which is we stumbled upon in 2016 is the insight that modern machine learning models, then state-of-the-art models, actually do not solve the task we want, right? And this is are some results from 2016 where we found out that benchmark challenge data set, which the community has been used for the last 5 years, no, starting 2007, actually 9 years, and one model which at some point in 2010 was state-of-the-art de facto, did not understand the task it should solve. For example, it predicted, as I hinted at, boats based on the presence of water. And if you look at the boat here, so in order to read the color map, warm colors mean this is information speaking for the prediction, for class boat in this case. Blue color means this is information which contradicts the model's understanding of the class, which means the model actually thinks the boat is disturbing its understanding of class boat because the boat is in the way of water. Similarly, we have seen horses, for example, horse images. The horse class in one of our comparison has been predicted equally well as, for example, from a more modern deep neural network. And we found out that this particular model abused some copyright information in the bottom right here of the images. Yeah. And used this correlation between the availability of the copyright image, because the data has been crawled from the web from some open repository, to infer that wherever there's a copyright, this might be a horse image. Or similarly, in the top right image, that there are some hurdles the horse is jumping over, therefore the hurdles might be indicative for class horse. This is what we call the Clairvoyance effect, right? And the Clairvoyance effect, in essence, is your model or your predictor giving the right answers but for the wrong reason. The Clairvoyance effect or Clairvoyance artifacts naturally occur in data, which means they are just there, they are some confounding features, they correlate with your naturally present samples, right, or features. And there is a related problem which in literature which you might have heard of, it's called backdoor attacks. And backdoor attack, on the other hand, is maliciously induced, which means you have some data and then you plant some features there, and you due to you relabeling those samples for which you planted the features, you force the model to behave in a certain way. And this can, for example, be abused by putting a gray sticker on an image and your image suddenly is predicted as a no speed restriction sign instead of a stop sign, for example, right? The difference is Clairvoyance are natural phenomena. Backdoor attacks are maliciously included in order to hurt models or hurt model behavior. Okay. Why is it called Clairvoyance? This is interesting because the term Clairvoyance actually is from psychology or animal psychology, and its origin is a math teacher and its horse Hans, which lived in Berlin in the early 1900s or late 1800s somethings. And this math teacher apparently or allegedly has trained his horse to perform arithmetic tasks, which means The horse was put in front of a blackboard, and some simple math tasks like summation, multiplication were written on this blackboard, and the horse would then tap with its hoof until the count of hoof taps equaled the expected result. And it worked with the math teacher itself, some independent examiners, etc. But later it was found out that the horse did not actually solve the arithmetics, but it was able to read the body language of the examiner, who tensed in expectation, right? So, in excitement, when the horse was nearing the correct result. And this is what the horse basically reacted to. Therefore, Clavin's effect. Correct prediction, wrong reason. Why do we need explainable AI? There are many reasons, some of which we go over or we touch upon in the following lectures. First and most obvious reason is trust and verification. For example, if we want to deploy machine learning models in some critical environments, we need to make sure that it's actually doing what it should do, right? It should react to the correct stimuli. It should be able to draw the correct conclusions. We might want to quantify model behavior, which means we want to measure how it behaves and not how it predicts. This is a difference between classical performance measures like accuracy, F1 score, which only measure the outcome. We want to be able to measure what does the model do, to what does it react. Then there are, of course, legal requirements, for example, the US, the EU, several independent countries, and they are proclaiming, for example, the right to explanation, or they currently are creating guidelines on how to use AI, what the rules are. For example, in the GDPR of the EU, there is the right to explanation, which tells you if your personal data is processed by an AI, the outcome should be explainable, or the reasoning of the model should be explainable. And this imposes some certain limitations of what the model can do, or what the explainer should be able to do around the model. What's personally very interesting for me is the potential for knowledge discovery and model understanding. So far in literature, in XAI literature, we have oftentimes seen that we are able to see that the model, for example, in chemical tasks, is able to, or is behaving in a scientifically reasonable way. This, of course, is not knowledge discovery. It's more like knowledge verification, that you can rediscover what we know from the chemical science, from the medical science. The next logical step for me would be we can use machine learning models on some still unprocessed data source in order to find out what the connections are between some still unknown features and what the model is learning from the data. This can be one main benefit of AI, basically. We use this machine to process large amounts of data, and then we ask the machine, what did you learn from the data? Then the last thing, of course, would be model improvement based on XAI feedback, which means detailed and specific model improvement, which will be topic in lecture number 3. Okay, so how do we do XAI? So for this, let's assume that we have neural network-like models for now, right? This does not only include neural networks, but pretty much any model which can be written as a directed graph of feature transformation. Some of you might know from the old days of machine learning, pre-deep neural network, although previously to the current deep neural network era, people have used back-of-words machine for image processing, for example. And in those back-of-words machines, there have been handmade processing steps of feature extraction, feature transformation, and in the end, usually there was a kernelized support vector machine to make the decision. But this can be written as this graph of, or this directed graph of data processing, basically, where each node and neuron is some feature which has been transformed from its inputs. Some of the methods we are talking today about use backpropagation-based approaches, which means they, after the forward pass, which goes through the model, follow the flow of information in opposite direction back to the input in order to tell us what the model has been using or what it has seen in the model, which information has been useful for it. Other approaches make no such assumption, for example, and they just take the model as a black box and work around this model in order to test its sensitivity, for example, by blocking out parts of the input and in order to assess what impact this part of the input has for the model. So in order to perform explainability, you have basically make certain assumptions or not, such that do we have access to the parameters, is the model differentiable, is it in a certain shape, etc. So there's different flavors to all of this. In order to give a short overview over the timeline of explainability, I've created a slide and aligned it to basically this talk. And first thing you should notice is that the question of explainability in AI is not new, right? In 1995, there's some guy called Moich et al., and et al. Are the other guys on this paper. And he described something which we know by now, usually due to this paper from Simonian, who does from 2014, which we know as sensitivity. And this is more or less a gradient-based approach to explaining models. And for example, the Shapley values and the bottom here from 2010 from, I don't know the guy's name, Strumbeli. This is pretty much the same as Shap, which reappeared in 2017 and basically became media present, right? But the main brand of explainability work started around 2014-2015. The colors here subdivide this whole space of explainability into surrogates and optimization-based approaches. Those do not usually assume access to the internal model parameters. And the other big group are backprop-based approaches. There we subdivide into gradient-based approaches. We subdivide into modified backprop-based approaches, which do something with the gradient or the backward flow in general. And in there, in the modified backprop approach, there are some decomposition-based approaches, which, literally take apart the decision function in order to break it up into a sequence or inverted sequence of steps. As I've already spoiled, there are a lot of connections between those methods. For example, there are some which are identical, some which are identical under certain conditions. And then there's, of course, further developments in yellow and, for example, theoretical backbones to other approaches in red and yellow. Here we are focusing on basically what's here in the red boxes. So we cannot cover everything, this is just not possible, but we can cover parts of what's in those boxes. So some flavors from gradient-based approaches, some flavors from decomposition-based approaches, and some surrogate-based approaches. There are two slides just showing you some references, so you can do some literature research afterwards. There's also a list of references after the talk, so for complete paper coverage. Okay, one question before we get at the methods, how can you do this? No, you don't have to implement everything by yourself. There are by now multiple software packages implementing certain XAI or several XAI approaches for example, different frameworks. For example, there are some for Keras and TensorFlow, there are some for PyTorch. For example, this Investigate and the Senate are toolboxes which we at Fraunhofer HHI and TU Berlin work with. Senate is the one I currently prefer because PyTorch is just, also it is aligned to PyTorch, and PyTorch is just, how can I say it, more researcher friendly if you want to dig in to the models. So my recommendation here. In the following, we will distinguish between black box and white box approaches to explainability. Black box approaches just assume the model is impenetrable, right? You have this predictor, you can put something in, you get something out, and you don't have access to the internals. So everything you can do is you can probe the model, and you can ask it, what would you say here, what would you say here, for example, by occluding parts of the image, as I already said. And then, in this way, build your explanation map for an input image based on perturbation of the input. White box methods, on the other hand, are the group of methods which assume access to model internals, which means you have access to weights, you have access to gradients. Usually those methods are backpropagation based because they make use of the architecture of the model and the internal parameters. And as such, they are usually much faster than the black box methods because if you do one prediction, you can do one backward pass, which is a modified backward pass, and then you get your immediate answer to this particular decision. While in the black box case, you do one prediction, and then you have to ask the model 1,000 times, what do you think about of this, in order to cover all the potential features in input space, and even then you probably don't have covered everything. So, but let's start with occlusion. Occlusion is pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. It works around the model, which means you have your predictor F, and what the model does in order to find out how relevant one feature I is, for example, a pixel or a group of pixels or some latent feature, for example, it changes this particular feature and then it records the difference between the model prediction and the model prediction on the perturbed feature. For example, let's look at this input image of this cat and the Bernese mountain dog, and the model thinks, ah, this is my input X, and the output is, this is a Bernese mountain dog. We ask, why do you think that? And we start by perturbing the input image, which means, in this case, we occlude parts of the image. Of course, here you have to make the choice, how large is the occlusion? What's the shape of the occlusion? Does it overlap in a windowed, basically sliding window approach? What do you occlude it with? Just, these are critical decisions, and those might affect the explanation, which is suboptimal, but it's basically there's no free lunch. And then what we record is the difference between both predictions, and we can paint this output score on the heat map. This is our first building block. And then we repeat this process for another time and another time, and so on, and we sum up all those contributions, and then we are slowly building the explanation map for this particular decision. And that being said, is we can monitor the prediction of the model, which means we can look at what the model thinks over this process of change, or what the model predicts for the class Bernese mountain dog, or we can do it for another class, for example, tiger cat, so we are not stuck in the model's own prediction. We can hypothetically explain every output. So we cannot, yeah, we can explain both classes in this case. Every class we want to know something about. This is basically the result of different perturbation strategies where we replace from the left to right parts of the image with random noise to maximally break up the structure of the image or, sorry, or we replace it with zeros in data space, which means usually if you put a data point in the neural network, it is normalized, right? It is shifted to, I don't know, from, also RGB images are usually placed between 0 and 255 integer valued per pixel. And what you do is, in order to make it processable for the neural network and more nice to process is you shift it to some mean standard position. So usually what you do is, or what you can do, which is a bit, little bit rough, is you shift it to -1 and 1 by shifting and normalization, right? And replacing with zeros here is similar to switching off the input neurons, right? This is the zero replacement works in input space of the model, which is different from the pixel space. This is important to know. Therefore, the zero replacement is different from the black replacement, which is the third panel. Black replacement just says everything, every pixel to the lowest value. And if we translate it to the neural network input space, we might arrive at -1, for example, due to the normalization, because we shift from 0 and 255 to -1 and 1. And the right variant replaces images with gray pixels in input space. And as you can see, every choice of replacement results in a different explanation of the model behavior. There are some key points which remain similar. For example, if we say this is tiger cat, right? We see that in the left, the tiger cat is always positively highlighted. So this has the largest effect on the model deciding for tiger cat, which we measure by taking it away and seeing how it impacts the model decision. The remaining parts, however, they might change. So parameters have a huge impact on explaining models. Then there's a...
Sorry, what is the typical size that you would use?
This is, depends on how much time you want to spend doing this. Because here, on this very laptop, one of such explanations takes 120 seconds, right? On a CPU, two physical cores, no GPU. You can of course speed this up by using a GPU, stacking all your perturbed images into a batch and feeding it all into a powerful GPU, right? And this takes much less time to do all this kind of stuff. So it's always a trade-off between how much time can you spend, how much compute resource can you spend in order to come up with this, right? But 120 seconds for one decision for which the prediction, explanation for which the model decision takes about 0.2 seconds, it's a bit much, right? As I said, there's no free lunch. Here you don't have access to the model parameters. You can conveniently work around the predictor, don't have to get into the model, but you pay with time. So the question is, as always, it depends. Then there's another series of methods which can be categorized as surrogate methods. They also work in a perturbation style framework. And one particularly interesting, or not really interesting, but popular method is LIME, which is short for locally interpretable model agnostic explanations. And this works like this. We assume that the model F we want to explain is too complex. We just don't have access. We cannot feasibly make a sense of it. For example, those are two cases of why we would want to use such perturbation-based or surrogate-based approaches. Instead, what LIME does is we train a simple model G, which processes either the same data or, again, some more simplified data, which is representing the original data. And we train this model G on a local subset of the data. For example, if you want to explain a data point X, we train this model G around X in data space. Let me have a look at this. Here we have this red cross. This is the point you want to explain. And this colorful, colored areas are the decision hypersurface of the model, which means it's highly nonlinear in this case. And what we do is we train the model G in order to approximate the behavior of the model F we want to explain in the first place around X, right? And this allows us to train G as a explainable model, for example, as a linear model. Linear models are inherently explainable because there's nothing really complex about them. They just sum up some weights and some inputs, and then they multiply weights and inputs and then sum it up, and that's your model. Which means that we have access to the building paths of the decision making. And the approximation helps us to get an explainable model which mimics the original model locally, but it's still an approximation. But we have something we can have a look at, right? So if you look at the right, for example, we have this complex egg carton shaped hypersurface. And if you look at this this cutout here, this can be approximated by a linear function, right? Because it has one slope. And this is something we can make an explanation about. The drawback here, however, is that this approach needs an optimization process for every data point you want to explain, basically, because here to the right, here the slope might be completely different. Here the model behaves completely different from this one, for example. Again, there's no free lunch, right? You pay for with time for something which you cannot access directly, or there are other constraints to it. The output is something like this, for example. Here you will see from the left and the original image of this dog in a shirt with a guitar. And the right parts are actually not the heat map by themselves, but they use the heat map here in order to mask parts of the image, which means everything for which the heat map, the explanatory heat map response was weaker than a certain threshold has been replaced with gray. So we can focus on the parts the model has used. And we see that for different classes, for example, for electric guitar or acoustic guitar or Labrador, the model is actually using different parts of the input to decide for that class in this case. So far for surrogate-based methods, takeaway messages should be you pay with time for not having access or not wanting to have access to the model itself. On the other end of the spectrum, there are gradient and sensitivity-based methods. And as I said, earliest works known to me, at least, is from 1995, from Morch et al., and then there's some follow-up works describing similar things. And the principle is quite simple, that the explanation to the model is the gradient with respect to its outcome. And this, of course, assumes that the model is differentiable. So if you have a model which cannot be differentiated, you cannot use gradients for explanations. To the right, there's the norm of this gradient-based relevance map. And this is usually what is treated or described as sensitivity. Let me check. Why is it? OK, let's start first. This, right? This looks like this, usually. What does the gradient of the model tell us? If you think about a linear function, do we have a pen here? Let's say we have some y coordinates, we have some x coordinates, and this is the function. What's the gradient of this function, right? A gradient at this point, for example, would be this slope, which means the gradient is negative at this point. And the gradient tells us what's the sensitivity of the model. Or if you think about this again, this is maybe a bit better, the right panel, where we have this very complex decision hypersurface, the gradient at the center of this shape here basically points towards a specific direction. And this direction identifies to which change, in which direction the model would be most sensitive to in this input feature. So, in summary, the gradient tells us where I would have to change the image to have the most effect on the classification outcome, because it tells us in which direction the model is most sensitive. And it's important to understand here, if you have, for example, an image as an input, which is usually a tensor of height and width dimensions and three input channels, red, green, blue color, the explanation here also is this same shaped tensor, which means for each pixel, we have a direction in RGB space which tells us how I need to change the model in order to have the most effect, right? This is, the gradient tells us the direction of the model is most sensitive to for change given this data sample. And this usually applies for any explainer, right? You have one, in image context, one explanation value for each voxel of this image, which needs to be made sense of. And what sensitivity, for example, does is they just take the norm for each pixel over the color channels, because the idea is here, as a human, we cannot make much sense in such a complex setting with gradient-based explanations. What we want to know is where, in terms of pixels, because each pixel is made up of three color values, where is the model most sensitive to? And then we can assume that the most sensitive areas are the ones where the decision has been made. However, the most sensitive areas can also be areas in the image where the decision has not been made, but, for example, the areas can be altered, for example, by adding another dog, right? For example, there's an image in one of our papers where there's a scene from, I don't know, some street where a lot of scooters are running all about, right? And we don't only, we predicted this with a deep neural network, and we found that the wheels of the scooters are super important based on sensitivity-based explanations, but also the street is important, right? And now we don't know, is it the street because it's there, or is the street important because we could change it to add another scooter, right? This is the context of gradient-based explanations. This is another key information I want to drop here is that given the choice of the explainer, the semantics of the explanation might change. Therefore, you need to keep in mind what the explainer is actually explaining. Is it the de facto use of information, or is it the potential for some change or some sensitivity, etc., and so on, right? So each explainer illuminates a different aspect of the model's decision, in short. Yeah, what you can also do is, which is shown here in terms of sensitivity again, you can compare explanations. For example, what I did here is I explained Bernese Mountain Dog and I explained Tiger Cat, right? We see that still, since we are using a gradient-based explainer, they are visually quite similar and also quite noisy, and there's a reason for that, and I will get to that later. But the point is, we can compute a difference between those in order to find out what not only to find out what speaks for or what, why, where's the model sensitive to Bernese mountain dog, but also where's the difference in the sensitivities. And depending on the context of the explainer, the story it tells, this can have a, well, meaningful output. Okay. Now, I teased this already a bit. There's a problem with gradient-based explanations. And if you look at, for example, this setting where we have a linear model, it has a bias, it has a weight vector, the gradient of the model for each data point is the same. Right? Because we only have a linear model, this is defined by its one direction data space, normal on the hyperplane, which means the sensitivities of the model are the same for every location in the data space. So it doesn't tell us very much, however, it's quite understandable in this case what the gradient means. How do we need to change the data to make it more class one, for example? Right? We just move it in this direction. For more complex neural networks, like what's coming next? Okay, one problem is with more complex neural networks is that there's an effect called gradient shattering, which increases with the depth of the model. And in summary, the effect is the following. If you have a do a tiny change or make a tiny change to an input image, this can have a dramatic change to the gradient of the model. And let me check. This can be explained as follows. Let's, for example, think about RELU deep neural networks. So deep neural networks using RELU activations. This is the most common used architecture right now. And what the RELU is, basically, it is a nonlinearity. It's a nonlinear activation layer in the model which takes an input, and if this input is larger than zero, it just returns the input as an output. If it's smaller than zero, it returns a zero, right? Which means, in the extreme case, one could say that if the model is complex enough, each data point activates its own private subnetwork in the forward pass, because it is a, I mean, features learn to encode certain information, and if the information is not there, the corresponding filter output will not be strong enough to be activated after the ReLU. It will be suppressed, right? And so on and so on, which means, well, let's illustrate this on, based on this example rather. We have this function f of x. It's a tiny ReLU-based network, right? And if we evaluate it one time, so the output of this network is defined in space, in output space from 0 to 1. And if we evaluate it one time, we have, for example, two slopes in this network. This is the shape of this function. And the gradient behaves like this. It's either 2 or it's minus 2. And the experiment we do right now is we just evaluate a cascade of those models, right? We place it after each other and we feed it into each other. And what we see is the more layers we add in terms of neural network layers here with more ReLUs, we get exponentially more slopes of the function, which means the gradient oscillates strongly. Now we have three layers, now we have four layers. I didn't show the four layers actually. But the point is, the deeper a network is, the more shattered the gradient becomes. And what we see here is, for example, if we move the input point a tiny bit, we might switch the gradient value for this input coordinate from 2, or in this case 8, to minus 8. So the more layers we add, the exponentially stronger the gradient might become, and the more discontinuous the decision hypersurface is. And this is a huge problem, right? For example, if you look at this function to the left, this is basically the maximum of x and y. And the gradient of this maximum function is then basically either in direction x or in direction y. And this function is discontinuous at the point where, for example, I'm still on the wrong slide. If you, for example, we travel around this point, right? We step a tiny bit to the right and the gradient completely flips by 90 degrees. And this can be exponentiated over multiple layers, which describes this gradient shattering effect. We have tiny changes in input space, we have huge changes in the gradient. And well, based in literature, this drags along a whole rat's tail of problems. There's then SmoothGrad, which tries to tackle this problem. SmoothGrad is a paper from 2017. And they see that gradient explanations are unstable. So what do? And having those discontinuities in mind and the shattering problem, they make a prediction, and instead of only using the gradient to explain the prediction x, they explain around this point x by modifying a little bit with a normally distributed standard deviation. They just step out of the x, then compute a gradient. In the end, they sum it up. And the intuition behind this is, if you have enough iterations of this process, or enough factors or gradients which go into the sum, the noisy parts will be eliminated, and the truly informative parts, which are the same over all those tiny perturbations, will remain the same. And the effect should be that the explanation becomes more clear. You're entering a noise tunnel, right? And this noise tunnel allows you to focus on the most important information, which is the most stable. However, there are still parameters. For example, you have the parameter n, which tells the algorithm how often do you want to repeat this process. And then there's the parameter sigma, which tells you how strong is the noise you want to add to it. And on my laptop here, for example, one gradient backprop took me 0.47 seconds. This is exactly the same as sensitivity here for the two classes. And if I increase the number of samples, we see there's something changing. This is for 10, this is for 20, this is for 50. We see that the heat map actually becomes more crisp because we eliminate the noise part of the gradients, right? And we can also compute the difference and see that, for example, Bernese mountain dog, this cat-like fur structure on the cat's belly, is not speaking for cat. So in terms of visualization, I forgot. What we usually do with smooth grad is we take the absolute value of the gradient, because as we know, the working with the real value isn't helping really much. And then we sum it up over the pixel channels in order to have something to visualize. And now we have 100 repetitions, and we see that the change is not that big anymore, right? Between 100 and 50. However, the change here between 200 and 100 is the strength of the noise. I switched from sigma 0.5 to 0.7, and here again the difference becomes notable. So again, you are in this game of tuning parameters in order to come up with the most, for you, expressive or usable explanations. However, as your n goes up, you pay with time. For example, this one, this quality of explanation, has cost me 142 seconds per class, instead of just 0.4 seconds for one backward pass. Okay, one quick short break.
Yeah.
Okay, done. So far, the methods we talked about were purely gradient-based, right? Which means they use the gradient, and that's it. Now we go towards a different meaning of explanation, right? Gradients have told us something about where's the model sensitive to change, and gradient times input should tell us something about which information is actually used by the model, because we have now this interplay between the gradient and the actually given input. The implementation is quite simple, and this is equivalent to simple Taylor decomposition. Taylor decomposition has been introduced in this 2015 paper listed above, and this can be visualized like in the bottom right panel, right? You have a gradient which follows the function, this is a green one, and then you have your input expression, which is the blue one. And if you do this component-wise, which means for every feature of x, we compute, we multiply it with the partial derivative, which is the gradient in this dimension, we know how much this dimension contributed to the decision. In terms of the linear model, this totally makes sense to do, because if you look at this, the gradient is always the same. Everything which changes from data point is the position of the data, which means the expression of the feature in input space x2 and x1. And what you see in the middle here is the relevance per dimension and data point. Can you see this? Is it too small? Which means that each data point has a different composition of input signals in terms of activations, weighted input activations, for the final outcome, right? The model predicts based on this dot product, and when we can put it apart, we see that the bias has a constant contribution because it's a bias, but depending on the position of x, the makeup of the decision process of the model is changing. And to the right, we can compare the gradient field to the relevance field, which means in each position of the, also while in each position of the data point, the gradient is identical for this linear model, the decision changes because it reacts to the different characteristics of the input. However, that being said, we still are tightly bound to the gradient because we derive the model at x, and then we just multiply the input, right? This is the gradient visualization again. This is gradient times input. It's noticeably clearer, but we still have in the contributing parts of the image, we have this gradient shattering effect. And I don't know if you can see it very well, but the areas highlighted on the dog's face, for example, there's a strong fluctuation between signs of positive and negative feedback for the explainer. And this is where Leiber's relevance propagation comes in. So as I denoted on the earlier slides, this is, talks a bit biased to my, to, towards our own work at Fraunhofer and to Oberlin. And this is a method we developed in 2015, which generalizes the principle of gradient times input by regarding the model not only as a differentiable model, because we, in this view, we see the model as a directed graph through which information flows, right? And in this directed graph, we have mappings from some input neurons I to the following output neurons J, and those mappings can be described as Zij. And this is, in this linear case, it's the same as the gradient times input, because the gradient of a linear model is just a sum composition. And we can, for this linear predictor, we can basically reformulate it in order to get the relevance values per dimension, which tell us how much each dimension for a given data point X actually contributed to the decision outcome, right? Did it do much? Did it do nothing? Did it contradict it? Then it would receive something negative. And as I said, this can be generalized by only looking at individual neurons in the network. For example, this is in the background, a visualization of just a neural network. It has many layers. Each layer has a lot of neurons. And if you look at this one neuron, it receives forward mappings, also pre-activations from the previous layer. So in the left one, left here, during forward propagation, we receive some activation values. And in neural networks, for example, there are some weighted connections. Those activations are multiplied by the weights, and what is then forward propagated is actually this pre-activation, right? And we don't talk about activations and weights here because this principle can also be applied to any other kind of neural networks, which can be written in neural network shape or in directed graph shape. But the point is, we arrive at some activation value here at this layer, which is a sum over all incoming quantities. What we then do just in the backward pass is that we assume that we know the importance value of this neuron, some relevance, right? You can for now assume that this just somehow arrives from the top of the model, and it is not the same as the activation for this neuron. However, what we do is we take this value and we distribute it towards all the inputs of this neuron in terms of this gradient times input step we've shown before, right? We see how much does this neuron activate in general. This is a Zj value. This is the activation strength of this one in the forward pass. And those Zij values are the pre-activations going from here to here in the forward pass. And this means each neuron in the previous layer receives a share of this neuron importance according to its contribution to the activation, which also means, for example, if we have a strongly activated output neuron and two or three out of the several hundred input neurons do most of the work in order to activate it, they also receive the strongest relevance in the backward pass. The others who don't do nothing, basically, they receive no relevance, but there might be neurons, for example, which fire against the trend, which deliver strong counter activations, which diminish the overall output. They then receive negative quantities, which because they are speaking against the output of this neuron. And this can be done for every neuron in the network from the output to the input. The aggregation at the input is just in summing up all the incoming messages, and this has a nice property that this approach is conservative, which means if we start with the network output and we backpropagate it through the network, whatever is in a given layer of the network is basically in sum the network output. So we have a direct linkage to what the model is predicting. those steps can be summarized as this, right? We have one decomposition step, then we aggregate it again, move to the next layer. And as I said, this is conservative, which means the relevance values you receive at any given layer in the network, they have a meaning in terms of how does this feature representation, wherever it might be, contribute to the decision of the model in the end. Heat maps computed with this look different, right? This is what we get for a layer-wise relevance propagation-based explanation for the prediction for class Mountain Dog, Bernese Mountain Dog, where the face is important. The cat actually speaks against class Bernese Mountain Dog, which we see because it is blue, right? It receives negative scores. The next one is the prediction for class cat, where the cat is highlighted, and the dog still receives a bit of positive relevance because there might be feature sharing between both classes. This one has been computed on a VGG 16 model pre-trained, and I just downloaded from the PyTorch, Torch Vision, something. If you, for example, would exchange this, this will be coming in the next slide, with a more complex model, a VGG 16, which performs better, then the model would not be confused by the dog's face, and we can see this in the explanation. And to the right again, we see the difference, where we see, for example, the difference of explanation for Bernese. Here, one single explanation costs 1.4 seconds, which is, on average, three times as much as a single forward pass. So considerably faster than other methods, but it has certain assumptions which must be met. Okay, this slide tells you that there are several rules for this LRP framework. There are two key constraints. One, decompositions must be conservative, so their relevance must not be lost between layers. It must be conserved, like flow of electrons, for example, according to Kirchhoff's law. And the second constraint is the decomposition must be proportional to what the model is doing in the forward pass. And around these frameworks, we have come up with several rule sets, which we recommend are applied depending on the function of the parts of the network. Long story short, there are basically some simple extensions to this basic rule I've shown you before, where we just add a denominator. We're reacting to the sign of the preactivation, which, for example, absorbs noise. For example, if you have worst case scenario, and this is you have a ZJ which is close to zero, but the ZIJ on top, which are the preactivations, they are strongly firing, but they are countering each other out, right? Then you would have a explosion of the backward process because anything divided by zero just becomes infinite, and this can be stabilized by adding an epsilon. We denoise the explanation in this way. Then we might, for example, divide between the positive and the negative parts of the preactivation. This totally makes sense if in a ReLU activated network, because positive preactivations have a different meaning mathematically than negative preactivations. This, however, does not hold if you have tangens activations, for example. But for ReLUs, where you know that everything which is forward propagated which is positive, it switches something on. And then we can divide this, sidestep some numerical problems, and at the same time, make some semantic choices on the decomposition, for example, by concentrating depending on the alpha and beta choices. Do we want to have more information about what activates this class, or if we crank beta up, do we have a more balanced explanation between the inhibitory parts and the activating parts? This is a recent softer in-between of the parameter space defined in the alpha-beta rule. And then there are also some heuristic choices, for example, where we say there are some neurons in the network we just don't want to care about what their inputs are and how they are transformed. We just take the neuron importance and uniformly transform them down to the neuron's receptive field. This makes, for example, sense in the pixel space, where the transformations in the lower layer of the network, they are usually concerned with making sense of the pixel space normalization. And if you regard this fully in the backpropagation process, you might see in your explanation all those effects. And you can skip this part by just saying, okay, no more meaningful decomposition, we just point a flashlight at the input and paint a more rough, but more semantically readable explanation. Here you can see the effects of different rule choices. For example, LRP 0 is gradient times input for a ReLU network. The epsilon variant is numerically stabilized. It's clearer. And to the left, you see the pure gamma rule applied. And what we recommend is the one to the right, where you have a mix of rules which progresses through the network in order to counteract the gradient shattering effect, which gives you something like the bottom right, which you've seen right now. And this is another visualization using the dog and cat image, where we have used a VGG16 model. It's a bit more complex, a bit more powerful than the VGG11. And here you see the difference between the rule choices. And to the right, there are the recommended things we configurations we recommend. And what you see here prominently is the effect of choosing this flat rule, this flat decomposition rule, where you go from really fine-grained structures, which are picked up by the lower layer activations, to more coarse structures, which reflect the semantic representations used by the model, right? And you go from, this is the most atomic fur pattern of the cat, this is important, to this is a cat's head or face, right? This changes the meaning of the heat map again, because you visualize based on different encodings of the data as learned by the model. Interestingly, there are several works in literature, for example, Deep Lift, Excitation Backprop, Deep Taylor, which are all connected somehow to this concept. So we think this is the meaningful direction to go if there are so many parallels in literature touching upon the same ideas. And as I said before, since we are not bound to activations and weights, but we think about pre-activations or quantity which are forward propagated, we are compatible also to support vector machines, and we can do non-differentiable arbitrary mappings, for example, from text to vector space, etc., which are not per se not differentiable. Okay, applications. How much time do we have left? Because this is basically the last part of the talk. We've talked about some methods, why explainability is important. Now we are a bit flexible in terms of showing how we can apply this and what the effects are in real application scenarios. How much time do we have?
45 minutes.
Still? Mm-hmm. Wow, okay, I was way too fast. Do we have questions? Let's maybe use the opportunity to ask some questions. Yeah, please.
So when you back propagate in the neural network using the white box method, during the back propagation, how much is the loss of information?
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question was, if we backpropagate with white box methods, how large is the loss of information during the backpropagation process? Right, this depends on several factors. For example, one big thing is the gradient shattering effect, right? Because if the deeper a network gets, the more pronounced this gradient shattering becomes, which means if you have some gradient-based methods, you will at some point lose so much information that you only get some garbled noise in the input, which tells you there are roughly something which might be important. And you can, however, take countermeasures. For example, like I just said, this layer-wise relevance propagation based different rules, which are actually designed to counteract the gradient shattering. For example, here, this alpha-beta rule. One particular choice we do is alpha equals one, because in ReLU network we say whatever matters usually for activating something is what activates something, right? So we only explain in the convolutional parts of the network, which is usually more depth and creates the most shattered gradients because of the effects of feature overlaps, et cetera, which are, so if you have one latent filter, right? And you output to this latent filter some activation in a convolutional layer, the gradient will not be backpropagated to an isolated input patch, but it will be superimposed by neighboring output neurons, right? Because usually they are extracted in a sliding window fashion with overlap, and this pronounces this effect. So there is inevitably some loss of information in there, and you need to do something at this. And what we do here is at a cost, right? We throw away part of the information in order to obtain the goal of readable explanation still. So there's always this balancing act. But however, the less complex your model is, the easier it gets. For example, 5-6 layers of a neural network is pretty much completely explainable if you just use gradient times input, for example. This is totally fine. Architectural choices have an impact. For example, convolutions amplify this gradient shattering effect way more than, for example, if you have just a sequence of fully connected layers, which are, well, not overlapping in terms of the input that much. Any further questions? Or does this answer your question?
Yeah, more or less.
Okay. So unfortunately, with all this kind of stuff, it's usually, the answer is it's not that simple, right? Because there's so many factors going in there.
I guess you can say something about the result that you have when you back probably. So even if you do the correct, I think which is one of the features of this back propagation is it can explain, at least if you can fully explain the answer of your electron, you can explain part of it, why it does this and that.
Yes, yes. So one key problem with neural networks is that basically you have this black box, right? You know what your input looks like, you know what the output looks like, but the transformations in between, they are intransparent. So what we do with the backpropagation-based approach is we just go back through the network and we try to arrive at the input in order to make sense, right, what the model has been using. But what the model has actually been using is taking place somewhere in the network. So if you could understand what the internals mean of the network, you could get really high-level explanations in the internal parts. And this is something I will talk about tomorrow, how this can be done. Because if you think about it like this, you have a backpropagation process from the output to the input of the model. You explain, in the explanation you get in the end, every transformation in the model takes a place in getting to this explanation, which means if we go back to the input pixels, where, for example, you have just edge detectors, and you also explain where the edge detector is active, right? And however, this edge detector is a really basic building block, and this, over many layers, those edges might be useful to describe a concept which is, for example, warm or rainy, right? But if you need to break the concept of rainy up by going over the edge detectors, you will inevitably be biased towards the transformations you are going over, right? In your heat map, you will most likely see something which highlights edges, because the edge detector has played a role in getting to rainy, but rainy cannot be tied to edges per se. So this is also something where heat map based explanations really are lacking, in my view. There's also one key constraint, right? I'm spoiling this for tomorrow, but whoever cares. When you have heat map based explanations, you have a highlighting of somewhat in terms of this and that context important features, which means you know which features are important, but you have no idea still what the model is seeing there. You know that there is something which is important. The quality of explanation there is similar to, this is a dog because look here, right? This makes dog. But no one explains to you why it is a dog. This is just where the dog is in the image.
How you compare different explainable AI methods?
Okay, question was, how do we compare different explainable AI methods? This will be answered tomorrow. There are several approaches out there. Again, it can be summarized that it's not that simple. There is very much literature right now trying to quantify explanations. And we are currently also, because of the difficulty of this and the false conclusions which have been drawn in the community because of the non-triviality of all this, we are writing together with TU Berlin again, we're writing a quantification toolkit which collects all the implementations and algorithms for quantifying XAI currently in one place. So people don't have to code it on their own. It just can just run it several times, thousands of variants, and then draw informed conclusions, right? Because there are so many tests you can do on an explainable AI, and they all measure different things. So it's like you can, you have to consider what the model is doing, how is it built, what's the context of the explainer, and what does your test measure? It's already three simple factors, if combined in the wrong way, can lead to meaningless results. And meaningless results have led to, unfortunately, some papers with very striking titles causing many people to think that explainability does not work, right? This is one of the key notions out there right now. There's many people saying explainability does not work, and they cite those papers always. But if you look at those papers, they are touching upon one fraction of the whole thing and draw basically wrong conclusions based on it. But more on that tomorrow. Yeah.
Can you assess the model of the bias in a model if you have one draw these methods?
I can assess the bias in a model if I have
bias. So in bug probability, let's say around, I want a bug propagate to us to understand what the black holes is doing.
Yeah.
Can you understand if there is a bias in the model based on the black propagation?
Yeah. So the question was, can I understand if the model is biased? You mean behaviorally biased, I guess. Yeah. If I have an explanation of the yes, this the answer is yes. I mean, where's the mouse? If I go back to the earlier slides. If you look at this, the answer is yes, right? So what we did there then was back in the day, what we did is we made predictions for the whole test set of Pascal VOC, 2007, it's about 5,000 samples. Then we created explanations for this. And then we looked at all the explanations, right? And then we found out, this is a boat which has been predicted based on water. Let's put it in the interesting bin, right? And then we collected this information. We found out that there are several artifacts or biases in the model. And this is just one case. The horses which are predicted based on the artifacts, this is a consistent thing. Boats, trains which are predicted based on tracks, this is also a bias. I would say, right? The point is, however, you need to decide whether this behavior for you is a bias or is it valid? Does it fit the context you want to apply the model in? But the answer is yes, you can find out the model is biased. And in lecture 3, I'm going to tell you how you can fix it based on this information. Okay, let's go over some. Any questions before I go to the applications? Right, okay. Applications of explainability. So in general, explainability is applicable in a lot of settings, because what we do if we predict with a machine learning model based on data is we provide the model with some numerical representation of this data, which means we feed in some vectors, we feed the vector through, and then we have a prediction, right? And on this basis that we have vector-based or matrix-based inputs, we can treat them with explainability and get some highlighting in terms of heat maps, right? The point is, you need to understand the data in order to make an assessment of the model behavior based on only heat maps and the data. This means, however, that we can apply it easily to images, because for images, as humans, they are easily processable by us, right? And if paired with an explaining heat map, we can make sense of what the model is doing. For example, this is a hammerhead shark. It's predicted because it has this back fin, right? We can apply it to audio signals, like in this, or speech patterns in this backup paper. And the image you see here is the input signal and the explanation for a waveform signal. What we've seen in this paper is, for example, that the representation of the data makes sense in order to understand what the model is doing, because no one really, the model extracts some information from this waveform signal, but if we explain what the model is using, it's not really helpful, because we don't understand the waveform signal. So one step we could do is, we could instead transform it into a Fourier space signal, or a short-time Fourier space signal, where we have then the spectrum of frequency and time, and then we see how the signal changes over time. The explanations there make sense again, because we see the model is using certain frequency patterns, for example, to distinguish between male and female voices, etc. So data representation makes sense. You can also use it on text data, because text data is at some point transformed into vector space. How has explainability in general been applied to in science? Explainability by now has seen applications in medicine. One case which I will highlight in a bit, which is quite interesting, it has been introduced in scoring the folding of proteins, for example, in order to see where the good fits are, where are the clashes in folded proteins here. There are some, basically, a list of an overview in this paper. mouse again. In this paper to the right, there's a list and overview of several applications. And one particular interesting thing is they used some gradient-based, here in this paper, some gradient-based explainer in order to find out poisonous substructures in chemical compounds. So the target was the following. They had some huge chemical data set, and they had labels. Is poisonous, is not poisonous. And then they just trained a model, a graph-based neural network, in order to classify the samples between poisonous or not poisonous, right? Poisonous in the sense of, if I remember correctly, the structures are somehow mutagenic, right? They interact maliciously with the body. And what they did then is they ran an explainability pipeline on top of those features and highlighted, were able to highlight the parts of the molecule which were responsible for the poisonous state. And this is where we touch upon knowledge discovery, where the authors of this paper were able to rediscover, or the model was able, based on this data and the labels alone, rediscover structures which are from chemical literature known to be poisonous, right? So this is a verification that the model is doing something which is chemically sound, which is quite interesting. And if we could, as I said, transfer this to new data, undiscovered domains, the potential here is huge. Another thing is it has been used for EEG data. It means time series, brainwave analysis for example, predicting of hand movement. This is, for example, important when you are physically impaired, you need a prosthesis, and this needs to be controlled somehow to understand where the signal is coming from in order to tune it, for example. Similar work for fMRI analysis, for brain state recognition. There's also work going on for brain age classification, where we then try to explain where are the aging factors in the brain, what does make a brain old, for example, or older. There's weather forecasting, the application range is huge. And what I find particularly funny sometimes is if you try to use it to understand your data source, for example. This is a paper I've co-written in 2017 and applied it to a quite difficult data set for age and gender recognition. So the data set has been crawled from the net and has been manually labeled for age and gender. And this excerpt is basically shows you the prediction process of a then state-of-the-art model for age prediction on face images. And what you see is in the green box, you see the correct label, also the prediction of the model. So the model was quite okay in those samples, despite being the task being super difficult, also for humans, right? Judging someone's age, totally hard. And for this input, this is an explanatory heat map. What you see is, for example, the prediction is class 25 to 32. Important are the teeth, the smiling, the eyes, right? This is the interpretation the heat map allows. And what's interesting is, however, if you look at this image, she's also smiling. Smiling counts for certain classes, but not for old people. And the reason is, in this data set, old people rarely smile, right? And one could use this kind of information in order to look at the data. Are there some hidden statistics in there the model is picking up? Like, for example, this boats must be in water, which is not true in general, in order to augment the data then, for example. What else can we see? Glasses, for example, speak for an older age, makes sense somehow. And here, colorful backgrounds, for example, accounts for younger people, small children, which wear colorful t-shirts, for example. Also, this paper points out a series of, also not directly, but follow-up work of this paper points out a series of issues, for example, with person-based data processing, because clothing has a huge impact on how a person is predicted gender-wise, for example. Based on this model, we've run a demo on some German tech, how's it called, exhibition. And there, of course, many people came around, looked in the camera, the faces have been picked up, the prediction has been made, the explanations have been given, and we found out that many women have been predicted as male because of they have been wearing shirt collars, right? So there, yes, again, we have been able to pick up a bias in the model by observing how it's acting on the data and how it's behaving, basically based on the features that has been given. And there are many other things. For example, earlobes, which are not covered by hair, are male features. What else comes to mind? Smiling, yeah, as I said, is a feature reserved for young people, apparently, in this data set. And yeah, this can be also transferred to many other settings, for example, the medical. This is an interesting paper where my co-author Miriam Hegele struggled with for quite some while, because the premise of this paper was quite simple. Back in the day, 2012, we trained a back-of-words support vector machine. It's basically neural network shape, but most of the feature transformation taking place are handcrafted, right? Do you know SIFT features? Yeah, you extract SIFT features from your input image. SIFT features are spatially invariant. You put them in a bag, and those SIFT features are then mapped to some vector space, and on top of that, there's a support vector machine running. This worked really well for this data set. The authors of this data set, also from Tubulin, we then recorded this data set, we published it, and then we said, okay, let's do the most natural thing. Let's try the same thing with deep neural networks, see what happens. And the first thing what happens was that, so what we usually do in visualizing those slides, you see to the bottom right, those are the individual patches, 102 times 102 pixels. They are fed into the SVM model, and those patches, image patches, are already presented in this way in this data set, right? So we are constrained to the size somehow. And in testing, you do the same. You get those 3,500 times 3,500 pixel-sized histopathology slides, and the task of the model is predict where there's cancer, right? And what you usually do is you go over the input image, you extract those slices in a sliding window approach, you make a prediction for each one, and then you know there's a cancer in there, there's no cancer indication, there's cancer, and so on and so forth. And then you can, And then you can basically, similar to occlusion basically, for this huge image, you can put it apart again, together again, and see a very rough map of where cancer is concentrated or not, where each quadrant of this image is a 102 times 102 pixel patch. So what we found out is, if you are following this process, is that the model has only been able to predict on a very checkerboard pattern style, right? The compound heat map we put together again, it was this huge map, and there were regular dots on there. And then we had a closer look, and we found out that due to the setup of the data set, where the annotator of the data basically has marked the cells describing the label, and some automated tool has cropped, then centered on those cells, the model has quickly picked up during training that the only relevant information which is connected to the label is in the center of the image. And therefore, the only source of explanation is also in the center of the image. For example, if you look at the first row, we have this, I don't know what kind of cell this is, because I'm not an expert, but this class of the cell is a different one from this test sample, right? And the test sample, then we feed into the network, we make a prediction, and we get an explanation. And the explanation here is all over the place. And it is all over the place because of for the class we explain, which is actually this cell in the top right, there is very little information in the middle, which means, one thing you need to understand when visualizing heat maps is you get a map of scores, right? And you need to map those scores somehow to a color space. For example, from matplotlib seismic color map goes from negative values blue, neutral values in the middle white, positive values red. And you need to map the score map somehow, right? But if you have no explanation, everything in your numerical map is flat, and you need to align it. You stretch to the color space, which means everything which actually does not contribute anything suddenly looks super important, right? And this is an effect which only applies locally, and therefore this leads to this weird checkerboard pattern. And we found this issue, we fixed it by reducing the size of the network further and allowing for some shift in the data to make the model more translation invariant. So it can make sense of also cell information which is at the border of the image, and then the end result is basically a fixed model which is actually able to recognize the cell. So we use XAI to make an informed decision based on finding out what's going on wrong with the model. And the interesting part is, if we would have just analyzed it on the test set measuring accuracy, we wouldn't have found this, because the test set was made in the same fashion with the cells also centered in the middle, and the model performed totally well. This would be undiscoverable if you wouldn't look at the behavior of the model. Another thing is here, following the work of this Clevance identification paper, where we found this horse copyright tag thing, we've hidden a watermark in there, or a singular red pixel, which is hard to distinguish by the naked eye in some of the samples, and trained the model. And we found out that the model is, if the pixel is present, it's just using the pixel for prediction making. That's another thing which needs to be considered for deep models. They are complex enough to learn highly nonlinear decision surfaces, which means if there are several strategies presented to the model as different data sources that it can base its decision on, it doesn't have to use all of them. It can just pick one which is the most convenient, so to say. And it's also important later for evaluation, maybe. And basically we could then suppress this, or this is basically the reference, the debiased heat map. This is the one with the bias. And this one, the last one, is also quite interesting. The data set had labels for healthy cells, different cell types, and different cancer cell types. I think 3 types of cancer cells, 5 types of non-cancer cells, which have been labeled. And the model has learned, it has performed well, but looking at the heat maps, for example, those are the samples which show the original HE staining. HE is some name, as an abbreviation for some type of color coding, which colorizes those samples. And those are then the heat map representations. For example, in this bottom center panel here, the heat map, the model is basically screaming cancer all over the place. But we had a medical expert on team, and this was not the case. The problem was that the model was recognizing necrosis, which means dying or dead cell material, as cancer. So it's making wrong predictions because it is using some data where there is no clear definition in terms of labeling in the training source. And we could react to that by relabeling those necrosis sample, which is actually in the necrosis class, and then the explanation for cancer looks completely different, because the model does not confuse necrosis with cancer anymore. And this, on the long run, might cause the model, for example, to avoid false positives for cancer detection and a lot of panic. Also, if we stay in the domain of histopathology, this was one interesting thing. If you make a biopsy of some cell tissue, you can stain it only once, right? And each staining has a purpose. You try with the staining, and the schooled eye of a medical expert, you might try to make one diagnosis, which means for one biopsy you take from a patient, each stain has only one purpose. After that, it's burned. You cannot use it for anything else. If you want to do an extensive test series, each test has a different data sample, and each test means an incision in the patient. You might not want to do that. You might want to keep this as a minimum. And what those guys did in the paper was they collected this data set and they combined different data sources, for example, what's it called? Molecular features, so text-based data I'm not a medical expert, but the point is they combined different data sources, different training sets with different targets, and all under this a similar staining procedure. And then what they could do is, for test samples, predict for each test sample and then use XAI to create an artificial staining on the sample. For example, they took one slide which has been taken once, and then they create a heat map for cancer, for certain cell densities, for et cetera, blah, blah. And the beneficial part of this is that they can basically reuse the same digitized data for different purposes, which would not be possible in the de facto clinical workflow. So also we have, okay. And there's also an interesting work from TU Berlin where a former, how do you say it, Kommilitone, co-student of mine, right? He's working with AI in quantum chemistry, and the goal was, so what you do is, if you do material discovery, for example, assessing its conductiveness, you evaluate the Schrödinger equation, and this can keep huge compute clusters busy for weeks for one material type. What he did is he took available data, already pre-recorded data from some institute, and he trained a machine learning model on top of that in order to, for new materials given in molecular form, predict their conductive qualities. And the point here is that the accuracy of this model was groundbreakingly good, for one. And the second thing is, it was fast. So compared to assessing, fully assessing one neural material in weeks in a compute cluster by explicitly solving the Schrödinger equation, he could estimate its qualities using a machine learning model, a deep neural network model, in a fraction of seconds, which would already allow us to pre-filter for promising candidates for doing this Schrödinger equation computation in the first place. And the next thing is, he used an occlusion-like approach to virtually move a, I think, hydrogen atom over the molecular structure in order to assess the models, or not the model, but the molecule's reaction to it in order to find binding spots. So again, an interesting application of explainable AI in order to find molecular properties. Okay, this has been it for the lecture. If you don't have any questions, we will continue with the exercise in the afternoon or after the break. And your task will be to implement some approaches, some local XAI approaches, and play around with them just to understand, get a feel what the effects of different parameters are, what are the runtimes, which ones are class sensitive, etc. That's it from my side. Thank you.
Thank you. So we need a two here in this room.